Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Litigation and Professional Responsibilities and Legal Education Practice Groups, was recorded on Tuesday, August 30th, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we discuss professional ethics and the handling of the Texas immigration case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome to our program today two experts. We'll hear first from Mr. Thomas H. Dupree, Jr. He's a partner at Gibson Dunn right here in Washington, D.C., and he'll be followed by Professor Richard W. Painter. He's the S. Walter Ritchie Professor of Corporate Law at the University of Minnesota Law School. We're going to hear some just 2 to 3 minutes or so of background on the case, just so everybody understands where we are in this process from Mr. Dupree, then opening remarks of 8 to 10 minutes from each with Professor Painter, and then Mr. Dupree finishing up. And then, as always, we'll be looking to you for questions, so please do be thinking of those questions as we proceed through our program. With that, Mr. Thomas Dupree, the floor is yours.
Great. Well, thank you, Dean, and good afternoon, everyone. As Dean mentioned, our topic today is a somewhat extraordinary sanctions order imposed by a federal judge in the Southern District of Texas against the Justice Department and certain Justice Department lawyers. We thought it made sense today for me just to kind of give a quick recap of the decision and what actually happened, which I will do, and then turn the floor over to Professor Painter so he can share his thoughts, and then I will give my thoughts. Just by way of background, this case is the somewhat famous immigration case concerning the president's executive program to grant deferred action to certain aliens. The dispute here, or at least the order that gives rise to today's talk, occurred after the district judge found that Justice Department lawyers had misled him about when this program was going to go in effect. When the lawsuit was first brought, the plaintiffs, which are a coalition of about 26 states, had contemplated the possibility of seeking some sort of expedited relief, such as a TRO or at least expedited proceedings. And the Justice Department, in response, told the court that there really wasn't any great need for expedition because persons who were subject to the Department of Homeland Security's order, that is to say, people who might be entitled to immigration benefits under this order, weren't going to be getting anything and nothing was going to be happening for at least several months. And based on that representation, the case did not proceed through a TRO. It was not placed on any sort of super expedited track. In fact, the briefing and argument and decisional schedule was all adjusted to conform to what the district court thought was a several months out in the future when DHS would actually begin granting these benefits. So the idea was the legal issues could be resolved really before anything happened. Well, it turns out that the judge didn't quite have a true picture of the facts. As the court later found, and as he explained in his order, the Justice Department had told him one thing when the Department of Homeland Security was doing another. Specifically, Homeland Security, during the approximate 3 to 4 month pendency of the litigation, was actually granting benefits. And they granted benefits to a very substantial number of individuals, north of 100,000 people, during a time when, according to the district court, the Justice Department had assured him in both written pleadings and oral representations in court that nothing was going to happen for several months. Needless to say, when the judge discovered kind of what the truth was, he was not happy. He issued a lengthy order earlier this year that imposed very severe sanctions on the Justice Department and individual lawyers. The court explained that he was not going to strike the government's pleadings. He also said he was not going to require payment of attorney's fees. But what he did do was a number of things. One is he directed the Justice Department to basically conduct a department-wide ethics training, or at least ethics training for any Washington, D.C.-based Justice Department attorney who sought admission in any of the 26 plaintiff states. Another thing he did was he asked the Justice Department to furnish a list of the individuals who may have wrongfully been granted benefits, the 100,000 or more people who got benefits during the pendency of the district court litigation. He asked the Attorney General to report on what steps she was taking to avoid these sorts of things happening in the future. He wanted an update on what OPR, which is the Office of Professional Responsibility, the unit within the Justice Department that supervises internal matters and attorney misconduct, what they are doing. And he also imposed individual sanctions that appear to be the revocation of pro hac vice admission to the individual attorneys who had made the misrepresentations. I say appear because there are significant portions of the record that were and that today remain under seal about exactly what the individual attorneys knew and who said what to whom. So that portion of the record remains under seal, but it does appear that he imposed sanctions, including pro hoc revocation, on the individual Justice Department attorneys at issue. The case currently is still, the sanctions component of the case is still in the district court. There's actually going to be a hearing tomorrow in Texas on further steps. The district court agreed to stay the imposition of the sanctions pending a hearing that will occur tomorrow. The Justice Department has submitted a fairly extensive briefing package, including declarations to the individual attorneys involved, explaining what happened, explaining the steps they're taking, as well as a legal brief arguing, urging the judge to lift the sanctions. So the final chapter has yet to be written. There will be a hearing tomorrow in which the judge presumably will give some indication as whether he intends to adhere to the sanctions that he originally outlined or whether he plans to take a different course. So there's certainly a lot to think about, a lot to discuss, and a lot to talk about here. And with that, I will turn the floor over to Professor Painter.
Well, thank you very much. That's a wonderful introduction of the facts here. I am going to be teaching a professional responsibility for government lawyers course beginning next week, and I plan to assign the judge's order here to the class for discussion. In prior years, we've talked extensively in my class, as I do in my book on government ethics, about Justice Department lawyers and the ethical obligations of Justice Department lawyers. And I think that the lawyers here have fallen well short of their professional obligations. Let's start, however, with the obligations of lawyers in general. And it is quite clear that lawyers are required to make only meritorious claims and contentions before a tribunal. Look at ABA Model Rule 3.1. Lawyers are also required to demonstrate candor to a tribunal. Those standards apply to all lawyers in all states. The rules are quite clear on this. And when lawyers go into a courtroom and mislead the judge with respect to the facts or the law or any combination of the two, those lawyers are acting in a manner that is not only dishonest, and lying to a judge is something that nobody should be permitted to do, but in a manner that raises serious questions as to their fitness to practice law. In addition, the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, Rule 11, makes it clear that lawyers must make truthful, accurate representations with respect to both fact and law before a federal court. There are serious questions here as to whether Rule 11 has been violated. The sanction, and I will talk about sanctions later, ordinarily in Rule 11 cases, is the attorney's fees. So I'm somewhat surprised that the federal government has not been asked to reimburse the states, the plaintiffs here, for some of the substantial costs that have been incurred because of the dishonesty of the government lawyers. Another thing that's important to understand is that lawyers have a professional obligation to be diligent, to know the facts of a case before they show up in a courtroom. So when the government offers explanations such as the following, quote, we just lost focus on the fact, or, quote, the fact receded in memory or awareness, end quote. This type of thing demonstrates serious lack of professionalism on the part of the Justice Department lawyers. The lawyer's obligation is to know the facts, and just say it receded from their memory is an inadequate explanation for what happened. And this is the type of thing that ordinarily in civil litigation, if it were to occur, would lead to sanctions being imposed. And as I said, those sanctions usually are the fees of the opposing party. Moving beyond the general obligations of lawyers, I have particular concern that these were lawyers representing the United States government. These were lawyers from the Justice Department. Because there are additional concerns here. We know that a lot of Americans are quite upset about the president's use of executive orders to circumvent the intent of Congress. We've had controversies under previous presidents as well. This is not something new to the Obama administration, although certainly President Obama has done a lot of it. But this is about executive power and the legitimate reach of executive power. And when there are challenges to the exercise of executive power in this manner, the courts are there to arbitrate these disputes, to decide what the president can do and what the president cannot do under the Constitution and under the laws of the United States. And the courts are entitled to accurate information. And we can't have Justice Department lawyers going in front of the courts, misleading the court in an effort to expand executive power beyond that which the courts ordinarily would allow. So we are combining the problems of candor to the tribunal, the ordinary ethics problems with respect to meritorious claims and contentions, candor to the tribunal, Rule 11, that appear in all civil litigation. And we are compounding that with these serious questions about executive power and what is the role of the courts in arbitrating these disputes and the need for the federal courts to have accurate information. Bottom line, that Justice Department lawyers should not be lying to a federal judge about the status of a matter that the federal judge is hearing. And the fact that the Justice Department lawyers did not have the information or it receded from their memory, whatever the excuse, that is inadequate. So I'm very concerned about this. Why did it occur? Perhaps we'll find out at tomorrow's hearing or at some other later point in time. I have been concerned for a number of years, and I pointed this out in my 2009 book on government ethics, about over-politicization at the Justice Department. Under administrations both Republican and Democrat, I believe there have been too many political appointees, too much power has been given to political appointees, and we've had some very disappointing results. We've had Office of Legal Counsel advice under both Republican and Democratic administrations that I think has been subpar in some specific areas that are critical to our country and to civil liberties. And now we've had egregious and arguably dishonest behavior by government lawyers appearing in a federal court. And one of the things we need to think seriously about is how many political appointees, how much political pressure there ought to be on Justice Department lawyers who are giving advice to the government, the Office of Legal Counsel, or who are defending the government's position in cases such as this. And I think we need to think seriously about depoliticizing the Justice Department. This is yet one more very unfortunate occurrence and a part of the government that really should stand for the rule of law.
Tom Dupree, you want to take your opening remarks?
Yeah, absolutely. And Professor Painter, some excellent points in there. I should begin by saying that my current job is at Gibson Dunn, but prior to this, I served in the Justice Department in the Civil Division, which is the component that was kind of caught up in the litigation in Texas. So I have kind of a personal appreciation for kind of how these cases are litigated, how lawyers get information from other agencies or components within the government and then communicate it to a federal court. One thing I took away from my time in government is that I don't want to say government lawyers are held to a higher standard, but there clearly is a special trust that I think courts rightfully place in the words of a lawyer from the United States Department of Justice. I think when you appear in court on behalf of the government, you come up with a little bit more credibility than you would in other contexts. I think a lot of this is drawn from the fact that the mission of a Justice Department lawyer is not necessarily to win the case, but to see that justice is served. And if that means that there is a weakness or a deficiency in your position, you're expected to acknowledge that and be very candid and forthright about that, even if it potentially even costs you the case. I think also Justice Department lawyers, at least historically, have been viewed as fair brokers, that they will accurately characterize the law and that their factual representations can be trusted and taken to the bank. And so when something like this situation arises, it really is devastating. I mean, it's a black eye on the Justice Department because it really calls into question the credibility of, the thousands of Justice Department lawyers who appear in the courtrooms of the United States every day and can in some cases make judges wonder whether or not these really are the honest brokers that they've always been or whether they're trying to advance some sort of partisan agenda. So it's unfortunate and regrettable that we are where we are and that all this happened in the case. A few kind of comments and observations. One is, and this is difficult to assess because, as I said, a lot of the key portions of the record as to what happened remain under seal. But, you could have situations where the Justice Department lawyers are given bad information by someone, often a, politically motivated actor somewhere within the federal government who either, intentionally misleads the Justice Department lawyers, knowing that it's not them who's going to be up there making representations to a federal court. In other cases, either through inadvertence or incompetence, they may simply convey inaccurate information. And then they send out the Justice Department lawyer to make the statements on behalf of the government. And of course, when the House of Cards collapses and everyone points fingers, it's the Justice Department lawyer who's left holding the bag. Now, we don't know what happened in this case. As I said, the evidence is under seal, and so I think we're going to be speculating either way as to know, who really is truly at fault. But I will say this. I mean, at a minimum, I think it's fair to require Justice Department lawyers to go the extra mile, to conduct their due diligence, and to really push people within the bureaucracy to make sure that the facts and the representations they're making to the federal court are accurate. And just as a lawyer in private practice really is duty bound to push his or her client to make sure that they have an accurate picture of the facts before they sign their name to something in federal court saying this is so, the same applies to the Justice Department lawyer, that you can have people in the bureaucracy who, for whatever reason, are not going to be providing you with the whole truth, and you really have a duty to ferret out the truth if you're going to be presenting that to the federal court. A few other observations. One, I think, somewhat extraordinary aspect of this case is the nature of the sanction that the district court imposed. I mean, in most cases involving sanctions, the sanctions are typically confined to the individual lawyer or lawyers found to be at fault. Here, of course, the district judge went considerably beyond that, ordering a variety of relief, including the furnishing of the 100,000 individuals, their names, people who are apparently wrongfully granted benefits, as well as ordering a, you know, effectively department-wide remedial ethics program. You know, here it gets kind of tricky because when I was in the Justice Department, you occasionally would be confronted with situations where judges just might have a disagreement with the administration, that they might be of kind of a, you know, different ideological background, and they disagreed with the Justice Department's litigating position in a case, and they would try to impose some sort of systematic relief, as they saw it, on the administration as a whole, or as on the Justice Department as a whole. And that always gave me some degree of pause. You know, again, it's hard to comment on this particular case since we don't know all the facts in the public record, but at least I would be hesitant anytime I saw a district judge threatening to impose some sort of department-wide sanction under the theory that, well, even though it was a discrete number of identifiable individuals who committed the misconduct, we're nonetheless going to impose what amounts to a sanction on potentially thousands of people. I understand the concern that what happened in this case, you know, may be emblematic of a larger problem within the department. And certainly when kind of we look back at the last few years of what's been going on in the executive branch and a variety of agencies, we've seen the politicization of the IRS and other agencies. It's easy to see how judges and other impartial observers could reach that same conclusion. But I will say that anytime a sanction extends beyond the individuals at issue, I think that there needs to be some sort of special justification for a broader sanction. The final point I want to make, and in this response to Professor Painter's thoughtful remarks about the role of political appointees, my understanding, again, not public record, but my understanding is that the individuals at issue in this case were a combination of political appointees and career appointees. And I think in my experience, and again, full disclosure, I was a political appointee within the Justice Department. My, I guess, recommendation is that, you know, I think there is a role for political appointees when a new president comes in. I think that new president is entitled to fill positions within the executive branch with persons of their own choosing. If a president is restricted to making, you know, a handful of appointments within a large federal agency, it can be very difficult to kind of, you know, turn the ship, so to speak, and for the president to really control the agency and push it in the direction that he wants to take it. So I can see a role for political appointees, and I think it's a valuable role and one that's consistent with our constitutional structure. Now, that said, as Professor Painter correctly notes, there is a risk that you are going to get people, including within the Justice Department, who place kind of their ideological and partisan allegiance above their ethical duties. That's always a risk. I think in that situation, I think the best guidance to give any incoming administration is that while you certainly can and should select people who will be supportive of the president's agenda, the selections, particularly in the Justice Department, should be based on merit, not solely on the person's background or ideology or partisanship. That can be taken into account, but at the end of the day, you want to choose people who are talented, who are persons of integrity, who are going to tell the court the truth, regardless of what their own personal partisan views might be. I think that's very important throughout the government. I think that consideration has particular resonance in the Justice Department, given attorneys' independent ethical duties, as well as given the historic role of the Justice Department and the stellar reputation that for so many years it has enjoyed in the federal courtrooms of the United States, that when a judge hears something from a Justice Department lawyer, you can take it to the bank. So those are my thoughts. Again, it's a fascinating case. I think we'll all be very eager to hear what develops tomorrow and going forward down in Texas.
Thank you, gentlemen. This is Dean Reuter. I want to open the floor to questions so people can begin queuing up in a moment. We'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, to request the floor, to ask a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to our first caller, Let me make a quick announcement about a special telephone call we have tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. We'll be discussing with West Virginia Solicitor General Albert Lin a sort of a preview of the Clean Power Plan en banc argument to be heard in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals late next month. That could be one of the most important circuit court cases heard in a great while. That, again, is tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Today, of course, we're talking about other litigation and the conduct of government attorneys. If you have a question, push the star button and the pound button. We'll start today with three questions. Let's take that first call of the day.
Yeah, this is Mike Doherty. I'm in Atlanta, and I'd like to hear a little bit about actually holding people accountable within the system. I understand the prestigious positions of trust that the Justice Department attorneys have, and coming from a law enforcement family, I have to say that the vast majority of people are quite ethical and take great pride in their work. That being said, I think the self-management and the self-accountability within government agencies that are full of lawyers outside of the Justice Department and the FBI are sorely lacking. And they're cultures that actually, in many instances, stop accountability. And to get accountability of those people takes a lot of money and a lot of political pushback, which most people don't have. So thank goodness for such things as court reporters, so it doesn't reduce to a he said, she said game. But what something's not working if the DOJ can get this far down the road in this case, and it's gotten this far. So where's the internal mechanisms to make sure this doesn't happen?
I'll be happy to take a swing at it. This is Tom Dupree. The Justice Department has kind of its internal watchdog, which is the Office of Professional Responsibility. And that is the component within the Justice Department that reviews allegations of misconduct by Justice Department lawyers and other employees, and is empowered to make recommendations, impose sanctions. Everything ultimately goes up to the Attorney General, of course. But that is the component in the Justice Department that is responsible for kind of the internal policing function. When I served in the Justice Department, that was a real component. In my role in the civil division, I would receive communications from OPR about people working in the division. I was in kind of a position where you would occasionally review these sorts of things, and it certainly was not toothless. People took it very seriously. In some cases, you sometimes would even retain outside counsel to advise you in an OPR proceeding. And the threshold for triggering an OPR investigation was fairly low. It did not require any sort of formal sanction imposed upon you by the court, but it could be triggered. I don't want to say at the first whiff of misconduct, but based on even a somewhat credible allegation that they would look into it and get to the bottom of it. Now, of course, my information may be out of date. I served up until the end of President Bush's tenure, so I left the department back in 2009. I've gotten mixed reports on where OPR has gone since that time and how it's functioned under the Obama administration. I agree and take the point that the caller that you made a minute ago, Mr. Doherty, about how if you look at how many Justice Department lawyers and other federal employees were involved in these Texas proceedings, and that it either never occurred to anyone or no one felt obligated to kind of blow the whistle and alert people that the federal judge might be being fed bad information, that is serious cause for concern. Again, I wish we could speak more specifically to it if we had a better record of who knew what when, but I completely agree with you that when you have a situation where Justice Department lawyers were making for months and months and months what even the Justice Department now acknowledges were not fully accurate factual representations to the judge, that you do have a problem that probably and almost all certainty extends beyond the individual lawyers at issue.
Professor Painter, do you want to respond here?
Well, I was the chief ethics lawyer in the Bush White House in 2005 to 2007, so I only had secondhand information about what was going on over in the Justice Department. As I recall, our track record in the civil division and on the criminal side was very, very strong in the ethics area. and we had relatively little controversy. I think the controversies under the Bush administration and the Justice Department tend to be in OLC with the torture memos that I certainly don't think were well done, and then also the issue, the personnel issues, the hiring and firing of U.S. attorneys. So different administrations are going to have problems in different areas. But I do think that accountability is critical throughout the government, but the Justice Department is special in many ways. The Justice Department is responsible for upholding the law, for enforcing the law, for prosecuting criminal violations of the law. There's an enormous amount of power in the Justice Department, and it's critical that that be implemented in a fair way and in an honest and transparent way. And that's not what happened here. I'm not for removing all political appointees from the Justice Department. It's a question of how many what the involvement should be of other attorneys whether the president's position on what is arguably is a very emotional issue, the immigration issue. And here these are cases involving the rights of children. I can understand how people can get very emotionally engaged with the policy side of the debate. And the president has put a lot on the line politically with respect to this issue. And I understand that, but we need to have Justice Department lawyers who can distance themselves from the political agenda of the president, from the emotional issues here, and focus on the law, and at a minimum, make absolutely sure they are telling the truth, the complete truth, to a federal judge who's hearing a case about the government's use of its powers. And it's very unfortunate that that is not what happened here.
We're in the question and answer portion of our program now. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got two questions pending, but I'm going to take the liberty to ask a follow-up question here if I could. And it's about you both mentioned sort of a slightly higher standard on government attorneys, certainly on Department of Justice attorneys, because they represent the government. But I assume they also, you know, have the full weight of the government behind them and therefore have a special responsibility. Does that extend to agency lawyers outside the Department of Justice? And I'm thinking here about proceedings that can be just as consequential and have just as negative an impact on someone from the regulated community, but they happen in front of an ALJ with a Securities and Exchange Commission attorney or an FDA attorney or whatever the case might be, arguing in front of an ALJ, a less formal proceeding. Maybe the facts are not as well developed. I'm not sure, but I'm wondering if either of you have opinions on the standards of behavior for what must be the predominant mode of activity of government attorneys, and that's not in federal court, but in some of these other lesser proceedings.
This is Richard Painter. I'm a securities lawyer. I've taught securities regulation for over 20 years, and I've dealt with the SEC, and I would say the vast majority of cases, almost all that I've witnessed with the SEC, there's been a very high level of professionalism. And I believe that's true of most all government agencies, and that what we've seen here is an exception rather than a common occurrence. But I do think the political pressures, whether in agencies or in government, on Justice Department lawyers or other agencies, that political pressures can make these situations worse. And ironically, the higher the stakes, the more likely it may be that a lawyer is going to seek to justify to themselves and to others unethical conduct. I believe in the ends justify the means. And I want to reiterate that the ends do not justify the means, and that's what we need to take away from this.
Mr. Dupree, anything on this?
I think that government lawyers just universally kind of have a special responsibility when they come into court and they speak on, you know, behalf of either the executive branch or the United States as a whole. I guess my sense is that in the context of Justice Department lawyers, there may be just a particular resonance given that, you know, they are typically or often trying to, you know, put people in jail, invoke the criminal machinery of the state. In this case, of course, the stakes were extremely high because they were defending a signature initiative of the president on one of the most polarizing issues of the day and a policy that literally would affect millions of people. And so in that context, I mean, in all contexts, government officials have to speak, government lawyers have to speak the truth. But I think particularly in a case like this, where the eyes of the nation are on them, they come into court bearing a special trust.
Very good. Let's now take another call from our audience. Caller, if you have muted your own telephone, you need to take yourself off mute. We've got a caller coming in from area code 510. We can't hear you. If your phone is muted, you need to unmute your telephone. I'll ask you to ring back in later if you'd like to, but we'll move on now to the next caller. And if you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, it's Mike Geske from Cause of Action Institute in Washington, D.C. Mr. Dupree, when I first read the government's response in the press and their first, I think they had an initial filing, I thought their legal argument was pretty strong that the judge may have overstepped what was before him by ordering or suggesting sanctions that would extend to the entire department and I think U.S. attorneys as well. And but then the factual response, the part that has not been, the part that's publicly available and not redacted at least, gives away the whole case factually by saying that, I mean, their defense is basically that from the lawyers appearing in court all the way up to the top, the facts receded from all of them, as best to put it in the best possible way, and that kind of giving away the cake that the whole DOJ does need a refresher. And I wonder, Professor Pater, why they responded that way factually when legally they seemed like they had a pretty strong case.
I have no idea why they did this. It makes no sense. This is not something that I would think a rational lawyer would think they can get away with, misrepresenting the facts, what's really going on, what a government agency is doing to a federal judge. So there's no rational explanation for it. I think there are irrational explanations that I've discussed already. I think people feel emotionally engaged in the case so much that they lose sight of the importance of the standards of candor required in a proceeding such as this. But say there's no rational explanation for this.
And if I could, this is Tom Dupree, if I could add to that, one of the interesting things about the government's response was a significant portion of what they said was explaining how the civil division is going to be implementing its own ethics course, kind of above and beyond what government lawyers were already doing, in response to many of the concerns that the district court had identified. They put in a fairly lengthy affidavit from the gentleman who runs the civil division. It's the principal deputy assistant attorney general, explaining, here is the program that we're going to be rolling out. And interestingly, he said that they were going to move ahead with this new ethics program, regardless of the way this sanctions case comes out. So to me, it was interesting because part of it, I'm sure, was kind of they're trying to, get ahead of the curve and persuade the district court that, well, if we're going to be implementing an ethics course of our own volition, there's no need to, impose the ethics course by way of a sanction. But it also is interesting because, at least you could certainly read it as kind of acknowledging a need within the Justice Department. If it was the Deputy Assistant AG's view that everything was hunky-dory and there were no problems that needed remedying, well, then they could just kind of say to the court, we respectfully disagree that any remedial ethics training is needed, and kind of stick to their guns and see what happens. But that's not the approach they took. They said they're going to institute their own ethics program, and it's going to go into place and go forward regardless of how this Texas case plays out. So I thought that was a very interesting strategic decision by the Justice Department, and perhaps a telling one as well.
Well, I think the president ought to be saying something to the Justice Department. When I was in the White House and we had a problem with someone leaking the name of a CIA agent and that whole controversy, the president ordered mandatory ethics training for everyone in the White House throughout the executive office of the president. I gave 8 or 9 separate lectures for everyone on ethics, a broad range of issues, including handling classified information and email. I gather those records weren't kept for subsequent administrations. But this is something that ought to be taken seriously at the very highest levels of the government. This has embarrassed the president. There are many people who think he took the high road on the immigration issue from a policy perspective. In a humanitarian perspective, but there's serious constitutional issues with respect to the way he's done it, and those issues need to be litigated honestly and openly in the courts, and the president's lawyers who are supporting the administration's position need to be honest with the judges about what the administration is doing.
Once again, our lines are open. They're wide open, actually. If you have a question, you can get the next question in by pushing the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We still got some time left, about 20 minutes, in fact. Let me, while we're waiting to see if somebody else rings in, ask a question. It's already been alluded, there's this sweeping order, that remedial order that covers vast parts of the Department of Justice. How does it work, if you know, or if you can walk us through how it would work in a private law firm, in two aspects in particular? Is there a precedent for a judge ordering something like this for all members of a national law firm, for example, or all members of one big law firm's office in New York or Washington or elsewhere? And secondly, I'm curious about fees, a fee award, which at least one or perhaps both of you mentioned too, as a possible sanction that could have been used here but was not. Are those fee awards in private cases paid by the attorneys themselves, and in government cases paid out of the U.S. Treasury? If that's the case, does that seem just way less consequential for federal lawyers than for private lawyers? And might that explain the sweeping nature of the remedy here?
Well, yeah, fees... would be paid by the United States government. The states that have brought this case, that would offer some relief. I mean, this is expensive, and litigating against the United States government is expensive, and the state budgets are tight. So I think there should have been some fee relief. Whether that would have served to penalize the actual lawyers or not, would depend on what the Justice Department is willing to do to follow through with internal discipline and findings of fact with respect to those lawyers' conduct. The state bars almost never respond to allegations of Justice Department lawyer misconduct. With several complaints filed after the torture memos, nothing happened. The Justice Department needs to deal with this itself internally. But meanwhile, the states that litigated this, their expense was increased for this behavior. They should be given their fees, their costs.
And Dean, this is Tom Dupree. I'll address your question about the private firm analog. I guess I'm aware of a handful of cases. I tend to think they're outliers in which a court has proceeded along the lines you outline, namely they find misconduct based on one individual at a private law firm, and then they impose a more sweeping sanction on that lawyer's partners and colleagues and the firm as a whole. I've seen it done before. Again, I can't say it's widespread. I literally can think of a handful of instances. And it seems to me that those sorts of sanctions are very difficult to defend because, you know, absent some very unusual circumstance where you thought that the problem that manifested itself in the conduct that gave rise to sanctions is somehow endemic within the firm as a whole, or that somehow the firm itself was complicit, it's hard for me to see what the basis is for imposing some sort of firm-wide sanction. I think in the vast, vast, vast majority of cases, you see judges placing the blame on where it properly lies, namely on the individual wrongdoer. And obviously they have a whole host of remedies available to sanction and remedy attorney misconduct. So although it's happened before, I do think it's an outlier sort of situation where you have the sanction broadened to penalize individuals or entities that were not found to be directly at fault.
Very good. Now we have four questions and about 15 minutes left, so let's return to our audience.
Hi, this is Dave Hickman out in the Seattle area. I was an agency attorney for about 30 years, and one of the requirements that we had was we had to be admitted to the highest court in one of the states. And frankly, I would be quite concerned if I was one of these Justice Department attorneys that I might be looking at enforcement action by my state for this sort of thing, which would basically deprive my opportunity to have a livelihood, even if I no longer worked for the government. Any thoughts on why the state bars aren't taking a look at this? I mean, the states were actually the plaintiffs in this case.
Well, this is Tom Dupree. I guess my sense is that, you know, there often is and may well be in this case a sort of cascading effect. It may be that the state bars will wait to see what the final resolution in the federal court is before deciding whether to proceed with reciprocal discipline or to institute their own proceedings. But I agree with your kind of underlying point that, you know, separate and apart from whatever sanction federal judge may impose on you, you could very well be exposed to jeopardy in other tribunals in which you're licensed to practice.
Professor Painter, on any comment here?
Well, it'd be interesting to see what the states do, but usually the states would wait for any proceedings in the courts to be completed. And I think that's a key difference here between that and the ethics complaints that were brought against lawyers in connection with the torture memos, which were advice given to the government that I believe was very subpar. But in that situation, you don't have an adjudication of the question of whether the lawyers committed professional misconduct. Here, we see from this order that there is a finding by a judge that the lawyers engaged in professional misconduct, and that is much more likely to be a trigger for bar action against lawyers. So I think there is some risk here.
Let's check in with another caller now.
Hi, it's Larry Callahan. First of all, in 1976, I left the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Francisco and went to work in the Office of Legislative Affairs at DOJ. It was during that time that OPR was created. I haven't followed all the law that's gone on recently, but OPR had a tremendous amount of responsibility and power. It either reported directly to Attorney General Levy or the deputy, former judge and U.S. Attorney, Judge Ace Tyler. I've forgotten which one, but that's where it went. And that the OPR had responsibility for not only Maine Justice, but also for the U.S. Attorney's offices. And if judges or even parties could complain to OPR, and their hearings were held, investigations went on, and I think God help you if OPR had recommended that something happened to you, because it was probably going to. But of course, that was post-Watergate. It was an attempt to put Humpty Dumpty back together again, but I'm sure the rules haven't changed. The second rule I'd like to mention is Rule 11. Rule 11 will take, it seems to me, if you violate Rule 11 in making representations to a court, that court can hold you, your law firm, and the client responsible. Someone who's dealt more recently with Rule 11 cases, I've been retired for a few years, and I've never had to represent a client in a Rule 11 case at that stage, but I'm pretty sure when you look at a multitude of sins, and it can carry to the Justice Department, the U.S. Attorney in the office where the assistant works, and also the client. So I think there's a lot going on here, and it's interesting that at the stage of this particular case where you have judges complaining. Oh, by the way, and it was not unusual for certain judges, I won't name their names, to constantly complain. And Mr. Levy would very kindly respond that in words a little different than I might use, that you don't know what you're talking about. But it was of course, post-Watergate, so everything had turned upside down. But I'm sure that same system exists, and I'm sure that one of the two gentlemen speaking could address that.
Any comment from our experts?
Yeah, this is Tom Dupree. OPR, I mean, it still exists, still functions. As I mentioned earlier on the call, when I served in the Bush administration, I mean, it was a real watchdog. It was not toothless. People, recognized its importance. They respected it. It was certainly not viewed as the sort of, component of the department that would sweep attorney misconduct under the rug. Far from it. I hope, I trust that it, remains a meaningful watchdog within the department. I admit that incidents like this give me pause, but, at the same time, in theory at least, it's still there and it still conducts these sorts of investigations. Needless to say, I think it's a, vital piece of the Justice Department. I think pretty much any federal agency needs to have some sort of internal watchdog that is viewed as, independent and not susceptible to political pressure and that will police the excesses, the Justice Department especially.
I agree.
Rule 11 in the civil and criminal context?
We didn't quite catch that, Larry.
Could you also address what I said about Rule 11 in the civil context and the criminal context?
Anybody want to take that on?
Well, we need judges who are more willing to enforce Rule 11. And impose sanctions. And both in the civil context and these, a range of different civil cases, including government cases, judges are very reluctant to do that. This is highly unusual, what's happened here. In the securities litigation field, it got so bad that Congress actually mandated back in 1995 that the judge hearing a lawsuit needs to make findings of fact as to whether Rule 11 was complied with, yes or no, rather than just ignore the issue and sweep it under the rug. So Rule 11 is going to have teeth when judges take it seriously.
We've got less than 10 minutes, so let's move on to our two remaining calls. Go ahead, caller.
Mike Doherty again. I'm going to whip back around here since we had some time. Dean had asked a question focused more outside of the DOJ, and I'm going to leapfrog over my issues with this and just try to hone you guys back into agencies other than the DOJ, because here's my bias. We've got a hearing in front of oversight in January of 2015 with basically 47 IGs that say they basically are being blown off by their federal agencies. So these are federal agencies full of inspectors and lawyers that have a culture of just ignoring accountability, and then that is a culture within itself. There's no accountability within those. Now, you kind of answered my question on the with the DOJ not getting hit by the DC bar with bar complaints. So I think there is a problem outside of agencies when it's not a criminal investigation. They can get away with a lot because we've just strung together through this conversation. Judges aren't enforcing Rule 11. Government lawyers have some sense of immunity, whether sovereign or I'm forgetting the other word. But it's pretty incredible what I've observed and the outrageous level of misconduct that has to get to people's attention. Because I think people actually get scared that there's no accountability. But outside the DOJ, which is sort of the Mercedes bedrock, I argue we have quite a problem. Do you guys know of any internal accountability like there is the DOJ and other agencies?
Well, this is Tom Dupree. I mean, I'm certainly aware of the existence of inspectors general in most, perhaps all, federal agencies. I guess I was a little surprised and concerned to hear that there's apparently several dozen inspectors general who don't feel that they're kind of being able to properly exercise their powers and get cooperation. I mean, I think in most cases there is, sort of kind of healthy tension, between the IG's office within a federal agency and the agency itself. I think that tension is natural. It is to be expected and it's not problematic. I think it becomes problematic when you have a situation where the IG is making recommendations or tendering findings to the head of the agency, and those findings are being disregarded or swept under the rug for political or ideological purposes. I'm worried that may be becoming increasingly prevalent. We've seen you know, the increasing politicization of a lot of executive branch agencies in the last few years. And if one symptom of that larger problem is the exclusion of the IGs, I think that is extremely worrisome.
I should mention, this is Richard Painter, that an important component of the ethics regime in the executive branch is the United States Office of Government Ethics, which not only promulgates rules, but advice under the ethics rules. And each agency has a designated agency ethics officer and others who work for the DAO. There's training in all of the agencies. I felt that under the Bush administration, when I was in the White House, we worked with the agency DAOs to make sure that to the maximum extent possible, we could get agency officials, both political appointees and career officials, to conform their conduct to the federal ethics rules. There's been much more extensive regulation in this area since the George H.W. Bush administration, when there were some major statutory changes in executive order on ethics. So I think it would be misleading to say that the government agencies are without ethics, but I think there's continually a challenge here that arises from political pressures, the campaign finance regime, which spills over into the agencies. That's been a huge problem. And then the revolving door in and out of the agencies with the private sector. And so we're continuing to deal with these challenges, and they're much the same challenges we dealt with under the Bush administration.
We've got about 3 minutes left, time for a final question. So let's see if we can squeeze this final question in.
Hi, this is Bill Hodes calling. I wanted to say hello to Richard. I haven't seen you for a while.
Bill.
Want to make a comment about the efficacy of OPR and also the state bars in coming in after the fact on some of these cases. I think their mission really is not, unlike the Office of Government Ethics, they don't give advice sort of during something, but they are an enforcement agency afterwards. My sense from recent experience is that they really have become, at least in certain areas, a part of the problem, and they circle the wagons and are not an effective enforcement tool. I'm thinking in particular of really bad Brady cases, not technical, somebody forgot to find one particular, you know, FBI report or whatever, but systematic, really bad Brady cases. The conviction gets over. I'm thinking of the Stevens case. There were parts of the Enron case and so on. And the OPR simply will not treat those seriously. They have a view that the constitutional requirement is the same as the ethical requirement, and it is not. The ethical requirement is much more demanding in all but about three states. And the state bars won't do anything about it either, and I think it's a very, very serious problem.
Response?
Well, I agree about that. I mean, the Brady violations are pervasive, and even a lot of violations that fall short of the constitutional requirement. And, of course, the ethics requirement is more stringent, and that is not being taken seriously. And I think one of the problems is that unless there's a finding by a court of a violation, the agency, the ethics authorities are not willing to step in most all cases. That de facto brings the ethics requirement down to what the courts are willing to do on the constitutional side. And that's, of course, in the Brady area, given some very, conservative Supreme Court interpretation of the constitutional requirement.
Tom Dupree, a final thought here?
My only final thought is just this case, I think, in Texas, this whole situation just strikes me as a cautionary tale and, frankly, cause for concern. You know, it's obviously not a bright spot in the history of the Department of Justice, and hopefully, you know, people, both present and, more importantly, future lawyers in the Justice Department will learn from this and prevent something like this from ever happening again.
Well, my thanks to our experts. We are out of time, but we're also out of questions, coincidentally. My thanks to Tom Dupree and Professor Richard Painter. This has been an excellent discussion. We'll wait to see tomorrow what unfolds in Texas as the court continues to grapple with this issue. Thank you also to the audience for your questions and for your engagement. A reminder that our next scheduled Teleform conference call is tomorrow at 2 p.m. We'll be looking at the Clean Power Plan litigation. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.